this morning. We're almost through this section of Genesis concerning Noah and God's great flood. We're in Genesis chapter 9. God unleashed the waters to flood the earth, to blot out every living creature from the face of the land. From the fall of Adam, mankind's sin had increased to a level that grieved God in his heart. Men and women were breaking all boundaries that God had set, and their hearts were filled with evil continually. But Noah was favored by God. He, his sons, and their wives were shown grace, and they were saved from this judgment. God commanded Noah to build the ark, and he obeyed. Noah was righteous and blameless, and Noah walked with God, and he did what God told him to do. God had come to Noah when he was around 500 years old, and this was the time that he began having sons. That's when his sons were being born. The flood came when Noah was 600 years old, and his sons were around 100. The rain came, and it lasted 40 days and 40 nights. 150 days of deluge, followed by 150 days of receding, 2 months of drying before God called Noah's family out of the ark. The earth had been devastated and changed, and the only life was that which God carried through the flood on the ark of Noah. This faithful man and his family left the ark. And right off, what did Noah do? He built an altar and he offered burnt offerings of every clean animal. In doing this, he recognized that he and his family were also sinful. They had deserved the flood and God's judgment as much as anyone else, except for God's grace, God's mercy. And so Noah committed himself wholeheartedly to the Lord through this offering. And we read that Noah's offering pleased the Lord. God said in his heart he would not destroy the earth again in this way because of man. And he showed his grace to all of mankind, ensuring that from now on the sun and the rain, springtime and harvest, night and day would not cease until the end, until Christ comes. And God blessed Noah and his family, and he called on them to be fruitful, to multiply, and to fill the earth. And he placed a fear of man into the animal kingdom, and he gave them into man's hand for food and for use. He did establish boundaries, not to eat the blood, for in the blood is its life. And we saw last week that God placed a great value on all living creatures. He placed a greater value on human life, and when a human's blood is shed, it requires a reckoning. Life is precious. He called on Noah's family to be fruitful, to multiply, and to fill the earth. We come to Genesis 9, verse 8 this morning. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, "Behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you. And with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you, as many as came out of the ark, it is for every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you, that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." And God said, "This is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you, and every living creature that is with you, for all future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that's on the earth." God said to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth." The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the people of the whole earth were dispersed. Noah began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both of their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned backward, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years. And he died. Then God said to Noah and his sons with him, "Behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, every beast of the earth with you, for every beast on earth, a covenant with all that is alive and all that will live from that point forward." Here's the promise of this covenant. There's always a promise. Here's the promise. Here's the vow, the action of the covenant that's being established between God and all living creatures. He says, "I will never destroy all life by flood again." And then God gives a sign of this covenant for them and for all future generations and for himself. A sign, a symbol of the covenant, a reminder, a visible token that speaks to the promise and the commitment of the covenant. Think of a marriage covenant between a man and a woman. What is often the sign or the symbol of that covenant? It's the ring. We've all been to marriage ceremonies, and we see that rings are given one to another, and they are a symbol or a token of this covenant, this promise that's being made, this vow. And they wear the ring to remind them, each one, of their covenant promises, that they had promised to remain faithful. They promised to continue to love the other, no matter what comes. This would be a reminder for them. Not that they would need a reminder, but every time they would see the ring, they would think of the love that they have for their spouse. They would think of the promises that were made. It would be assurance, reassurance, reminder. It also would proclaim to everyone else, "I've made a promise." God, as a symbol, as a token of this covenant, this vow that he's making with mankind and to all of the living creatures, is he puts a bow in the cloud, a rainbow. It's to assure them, all those who would see it, of this covenant that he's made, this vow, this promise that he's made to them. Why do you think that that symbol was important? Thought about this as sinners. Each of these family members knew that they were sinners. They knew that it was only by God's grace that they were carried through the flood. And so afterwards, in this desolate landscape where they're the only things alive, every single time a cloud would come and they would see that dark cloud and feel that first sprinkle on their forehead, wouldn't you wonder? Uh-oh. I wonder if we've overstepped. I wonder if my sin has been too much. We would start to worry. The question would at least rise in your hearts. I remember after 9/11, I remember being at one of the boys' baseball games. And all of a sudden, one of the planes that was going to Torrance Airport came a little bit low. And everyone heard it. You saw everyone in the stands hold their breath for a minute. It took a while before the planes flying low didn't make you stop for a moment and wonder if something was about to happen. For these folks that had come through the flood, had been tossed and turned for a year in the boat, seeing everything killed in God's judgment on sin, knowing that they themselves were sinners, every time they saw a rain cloud, it would make them a little nervous. God says, "No. When you see a cloud where there's rain, you're going to see that rainbow, and you're going to be reassured. And it will remind me that I made a promise to you, And I think it's ironic that today that symbol, think about where that symbol is flown, where that flag is flown, where it's worn, where it's shown, those locations and places. God says, it will be a reminder to me not to destroy all flesh by flood again, despite their sin-filled hearts. It's a good promise. It's a good symbol. We're told in verse 18 that the sons of Noah who went forth from the ark, the sons who no doubt helped build it, helped care for the animals. So oftentimes we think of the sons being teenagers as they get off the ark or very young. They're 100 years old. Remember how long it took to build the ark? They grew up helping Dad build the ark, enduring everything that Dad endured, gathering the animals, preparing for the care of them on board, going through the flood themselves. They too were saved through the judgment of the flood, saved by God's grace, and their names were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And so I want to start off this morning with a little bit of a rabbit trail, just a bit, because it causes people stress in their minds. So let's remove the stress. Is Shem the oldest son? You might look and say, well, yeah, he is, because he's listed first. Genesis 5:32, he's listed first. 6:10, he's listed first. 7:13, he's listed first. 1 Chronicles 1:4, he's listed first. But if you also look in 1 Chronicles, you'll find that it's written that the sons of Abraham were Isaac and Ishmael. Isaac first, then Ishmael. Wait a minute. Don't we know that Ishmael was born 14 years ahead of Isaac? In Genesis 5:3 and in 1 Chronicles 1:4, it states that Adam's first son was Seth. Yet we know of Cain and Abel. This first that's usually noted in some of the genealogies, it tends to point to the godly line. There's an importance to this line because this is the line from which the Christ will come. So maybe he's not the firstborn. If you look at Genesis 10:21, depending on what Bible translation you have this morning, in the Hebrew text, and the Hebrew text is used in the King James, New King James, the NIV, it reads, and to Shem were born sons, and Shem, who was the brother of Japheth, the older. That's what it says in the Hebrew text. Japheth was older than Shem. Noah and had his sons beginning at 500. If you look at Genesis 11, verse 10, you find that Shem was 100 years old when he had Arphaxad, and that this happened 2 years after the flood, which tells us that Shem was 98 when they got off the ark. It also tells us then that Noah was 503 when he had Shem. Who was born at 500? Japheth or Ham? Leaves you one of two choices. Today's section, we're going to come to Genesis 9:24. We're going to find that the one who messes up is his youngest. And we're told that his youngest, his name is Ham. And so you get in your mind, you understand Japheth is the oldest, Shem was the middle, and then Ham was the youngest. And if you understand that, all of the verses throughout are consistent. Anyway, it's not a big deal, but this causes unrest and stress to some minds until it's reconciled. So hopefully that settles it. One other key diversion before we leave verse 18 is I want you to notice something. 9:18. The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Do you see the parentheses? Ham was the father of Canaan. The parentheses indicates that he's telling you something. He's saying, you should be aware of this too. It's important to the reader. Who's the author? Moses, right? Moses under God's inspiration. Who's the original reader? The Israelites. He came off of the mountain and he's writing all of these things that God told him to write. And what are the Israelites about to do? They're about to enter the land. What land? The promised land. The promised land. So we understand, when was this written? It was written after the Exodus, but before, well before the Israelites enter the promised land. And what did God tell them about the promised land? You are to go in and do what? Kill all of the inhabitants. Take over all of these places. One of the areas where outside folks look at us going, your God is a bloodthirsty God, because they're told to go in and possess the land. I'm giving it to you. They're about to go into this promised land. Promised land. Who promised it to them? God had 450 years earlier. Turn to Genesis chapter 15. I just want you to look at Genesis 15, verses 12 to 21. This is when God makes a covenant with Abraham. Abraham's already cut them in half, put them on both sides, and so we're about to come to this place where God walks between the animals. Verse 12, as the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram, and behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. Then the Lord said to Abram, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. He's speaking there about Egypt. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions, the Exodus. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. When the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. And on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your offspring I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. If I was teaching my youth group, I'd also say the Dynamites, the Pantsuitites, but that's just a youth group joke. You see all of these names. God lets Abram know that they're going to come into the land much later. Why? Why is it delayed? What's much later? Because the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Their sin's not yet at the point to its fullness that is going to cause God to remember them. Remember when he remembers and acts. Takes care of all of that sin. It's not yet to that point. But in the promise, God lets Abraham know who's dwelling there. Who it is that they're going to overthrow. The Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, all the ites. So who are these people? Turn left. Go back to Genesis 10. We're going to get to this next week. Look at Genesis 10, 6. The sons of Ham were Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. Do you see that? Now turn over to 15. Canaan's sons. Canaan fathered Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusites, and the Amorites, and the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, the Arvadites, the Zemarites, and the Hamathites. Afterward, the clans of the Canaanites dispersed. And the territory of the Canaanites extended from Sidon in the direction. If you're looking at that, you'll see where they landed. The people group that's in the land of promise, that Israel is being commanded to go and take and kill and possess the land, they're Canaanites. And so these are all descendants of Canaan. And so Moses lets them know, so they see from God's perspective, that the iniquity of these Canaanites was now complete. It's time for God to act, and he's going to use his people as a sword. And fulfilling his promise of giving them their land, both are going to be taking place at the same time. And so as Moses then back here in chapter 9 dictates God's revelation of man's history, he comes to the sons of Noah and he lets his people know, oh, by the way, these three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham's son is Canaan, of Canaanite fame. Father of all the wicked Canaanites that you're going to go in and kill and take their land back that God has promised to you. God has determined this. It's just. This is God's will. This is his intention. So that provides just a bit of context into the first audience of the Torah. Moses writing to these that are going to be going into the land. This is what God had told him on the mountain when he was engaging with Noah. And so then we come to 9:19. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these people the whole earth were dispersed. We're going to get into that a little bit more in next week's lesson. Before we go into verse 20, I want you to understand that when we come into verse 20, it's probably 10 to 20 years. But to understand this section appropriately, I want you first to stop for a moment and consider what we know of Noah. Noah is favored by God, and he's shown incredible grace by God. He is righteous, which means his life is pointed towards God. He's blameless. He's wholehearted. He's not double-minded. He's a man who walks with God, which means he's in agreement with God. He's in relationship with God. He's a man who is obedient to God's command, and he's been so for centuries. He's a man of faith. He's a man of strong belief and trust in God. He's now over 600 years old. He's the patriarch over his family. He is their spiritual leader, not just of this family, but in fact, he's the spiritual leader of every living person on the earth. His family is now growing rapidly. The sons and the daughters-in-law who helped him to build the ark stood by him through those years of waiting, helped care for the animals. Together, they were all carried through the flood and the aftermath. And they were there. They saw that right after the aftermath, he's the one who built an altar unto the Lord. He acknowledged God as not only his creator, his maker, but also his savior. And he recognized that he deserved no less than all those who were destroyed. And we know that because of the blood that splashed, because of this burnt offering, recognizing that my sin too requires a substitute. In faith, he committed himself wholeheartedly unto the Lord, all of his mind, all of his heart, all of his soul, all of his strength. This is what everyone in this family knew about Father Noah, Grandpa Noah. Can you imagine the sons and daughter-in-law talking about Noah, your grandpa? Your grandpa walks with God. Your grandpa is a righteous man. Your grandpa is in relationship with the living God. Your grandpa committed his entire life, his heart, soul, and strength to our God. I imagine his grandchildren coming to grandpa to listen to the stories and lessons about God and his law, his judgment, and his grace. Their grandpa was a lover of God. He was obedient. He was faithful. Righteous Noah. Noah began to be a man of the soil. He'd been a boat builder and a preacher for the last 100 or so years. Then a sailor for a year. And now he's a man of the soil and he planted a vineyard. You know, to produce a vineyard that's fruitful takes a few years. And then he drinks of the wine. To get wine then to be aged, it takes a few more years. That's how they get to 10 to 20 years after they have gotten off. I want you to understand that. And he drank of the wine. I want you to know there's no issue here yet. Sometimes you'll read in the commentaries and everything, they start the issue early. There's no issue here. We get hung up on where the sin happens. Don't forget that Noah is a man kept by grace after the fall. He's a sinner. He made burnt offerings to satisfy God for his sinfulness in hopes of a substitute. This event, it's not a first sin. Too often we kind of liken this to that first sin in the garden. This is not a first sin. Noah is a sinful man. This is a sin that's pointed out to us. And what's pointed out to us isn't so much Noah's sin as much as Ham's sin. It wasn't sin for him to plant a vineyard, and it wasn't sin for him to enjoy the fruit of that vineyard. No problem at this point. Judges 9:13, wine cheers God and men. Psalm 104:15, wine makes man's heart glad. In the coming kingdom, the vine will yield its fruit. Zechariah 8:12. There will be aged wine at the feast that the Lord provides in Isaiah 25:6. In Proverbs, we're told that wine is a gift from God. In Deuteronomy 14:26, it's given as a desire of the heart. However, in the scriptures, we're given many warnings about taking care with it. Too much of a good thing isn't really good. A potential for blessing, but it can often result in curse. You know that workers in the temple were to refrain from it. Leviticus 10:9. Don't be drinking the wine. Leaders of the nation were warned to stay away from it. Forbidden. You're a leader of the nation. Don't do it. Those who vowed themselves unto the Lord's devotion were not to touch it at all. Number 6. Elders of the New Testament were to not be known as drunkards, but to be sober-minded and self-controlled. Better that you stay away from it. Why? Over and over in Scripture, we're told what wine does. It's a loss of control. It's a letting down of your guard. It's a breaking down of your inhibitions. And when it's misused, when it's overused, it causes us to sin. And this sin often carries immediate and far-reaching, oftentimes very visible consequences. Many warnings about drunkenness and the many sins that follow due to this vulnerable state that you've placed yourself in by drinking too much wine. I say all that, but I want you to know that the point of this narrative right here, the emphasis is not on his sin, but on Ham's. And we see it in verse 21, and Noah became drunk. And he lay uncovered in his tent. All right, now he's crossed the line. But look at verse 22. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father, and he told his brothers outside. Now, let me caution all of you, if you go into commentaries and listen to a lot of different folks talk about this passage, there is a lot of conjecture that's out there. I spent a lot of time this week just reading through it and to be honest with you, being disgusted in my heart. Lots been written about what this sin of Ham entailed. I know the intention as to why they use so much hyperbole and why they use so much conjecture in trying to make Ham's sin so much uglier. One of the reasons is too many people read this section and go, wow, those consequences are pretty harsh for that sin. Too many folks want to turn this sin of Ham into something really, really gross. Do you know why that is? It's because too many of us read the story and we say, okay, Noah had too much to drink. He passed out naked. His son saw it, thought it was funny, or at least didn't think enough of it or of him to cover him up. And then he goes outside and tells his brothers and made it known. It's not that big of a deal. That's the problem. That's how we look at this sin. And what's the big deal? It's, you know, kind of funny. If I saw my dad naked and passed out and he's no, wouldn't I think that that was funny? Would I run out and go and tell my brothers, come look at dad, look how stupid he looks? I want you to see we're shown what the sin is. You don't have to go to all this conjecture. We're told what the sin is by what the brothers do, because the brothers are given us as a contrast. They did the right thing as opposed to what Ham did. And what do the brothers do? They show us the ugliness of Ham's sin because they take a garment or a blanket and they carefully walk backwards into his tent and they cover his nakedness without looking at their dad who's passed out. And they walk out without ever taking a look, without even shooting a glance to see their dad in that condition. This is Noah. This is righteous, faithful Noah. Naked and drunk and passed out on his tent floor. It's not funny. It's not something to be told. Why do we so often when we do this, Lord, it's not that big of a deal. It's because, beloved, we have calloused hearts. Do you know why we have calloused hearts? It's because of all the filth that passes our eyes. As I was going through this week, I think that we're a lot like Lot, who lived amongst the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. And he believed in God. He gets saved out of there. But what do you see in Lot's life and in his daughter's life? That city, that culture had an influence on them. They didn't see sin the way they ought to have seen sin. A lot of things just kind of brushed off of them. They had calloused hearts after they lived there. We see that played out in their lives. Living in a culture around us, like we do, affects our discernment, our sensitivities, our values, our appetites, our affections, and it makes us numb to the things of God. What we allow our eyes to see, not just in passing. I'm not even worried. So many people go, oh, you know, when I was on the 405 freeway, I saw this ad and it was disgusting and it made me sin. I so often want to talk and say, what did you watch on TV last night? What movie did you go see last Saturday? What joke did you laugh at? What did you bring into your home through the cable line? What's on your phone right now? What's in your iPad? You know, you talk about this accidental sighting. What are you purposely looking at every single day? Every image that passes your eyes blinds you more, numbs you, gives you a calloused heart. We have a compromised conscience. Why? It's from all the sin that we're involved with, the sin that we allow ourselves to keep in our lives. Every single one of you has some sin that you're allowing to stay. Why? It's little stuff. I took care of the big stuff. It's the secret stuff. Nobody sees it. Doesn't get me in trouble. Doesn't hurt anybody else but me. It's the respectable stuff. Nobody else thinks it's all that sin. I can show you 25 people in the church doing the same thing. Compromise after compromise, and it compromises our consciences to the point where it quenches the Spirit's influence. Third, we have a corrupted mind. That's the result of having calloused hearts and a compromised conscience. We get a corrupted mind. It's handicapped. It's unable to value appropriately the preciousness of holiness, the beauty of righteousness. We're unable to rightly weigh the goodness of our God. I spent a long time wanting to lift Noah up to you. That's why I spent so much time reminding us of who Noah was, his testimony, his reputation, his relationship, his position, his responsibility. He was a husband, he was a father, he was a grandfather who proclaimed God as his maker, God as his friend, God as his savior. In the garden, Adam and Eve were naked and unashamed. Why? It was prior to their sin. They had nothing to be ashamed of. Do you know, once they had sinned, they sewed fig leaves to hide their nakedness. Why? Because they were now ashamed. They were now afraid of God's presence. Now, when God came in and he dealt with the sin issues, did he ever tell them, oh, don't worry about your nakedness? No, he didn't tell them that. He said, those aren't adequate. Let me clothe you. Let me clothe you. He clothed their shame. They could no longer look upon nakedness and innocence. Now, their nakedness revealed their sinfulness. What had Noah done? He had let his guard down. He allowed something to control him. I don't belittle that he sinned. Some folks try and say, oh, well, Noah, he didn't know. It was the first time that, well, look at this wine stuff and found out the hard way what it does. Stupid. Noah knew what he was doing. Noah realized he was moving from glad to happy, moving from happy to passed out naked on the floor of his tent. He let his guard down. He drank too much and he let something other than God control him. He got naked. Righteous, blameless, lover of God, obedient, faithful, spiritual leader of his family was lying naked on the floor, passed out, with his sinfulness uncovered, without shame. What if his grandson had come in? Hey, Grandpa, can you? Grandpa? His son, who'd been through the flood with him, came in and saw his father. And he either thought it was funny, or he thought little of it. Either way, he went out and told his brothers. His father was in a condition of disgrace. It's a great word, disgrace. You know what a disgrace is? It's something that is unbefitting of one who has grace. Noah had been shown such grace, and now he is in disgrace. If Ham had loved his father more, if Ham had loved his heavenly father more, and thought about the ugliness of this picture, what he saw, it should have brought sorrow to his heart. It should have made him run to his father's side to cover his shame and wait with him. Cover him and wait with him until he awoke so that they together could go and make a sacrifice, make an offering, and ask God for forgiveness together. That's what a loving son would have done. This is a big deal. I'm going to protect this reputation. I'm going to protect God's glory. I'm going to stay here with him until this is over with and we'll go to God together. You know, beloved, love covers a multitude of sins. Ham had thought much of his father's reputation, his word, his example, his influence. Even if not that, if he had just thought about his heavenly father's holiness, righteousness, and grace, he would have covered him up. But instead, he went out and he told others of his father's nakedness. Beloved, these aren't high school boys. They're 100-year-old men who'd been through the flood, who had seen massive devastation and seen God's grace and knew of his law and knew of his judgment and knew of his mercy. They knew that this God was not a God to be trifled with. Shem and Japheth carefully go in not to see him, not to laugh at him, but to cover him up. Do you see the gravity of the sin, Ham? I pray that you do. When Noah woke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he realized what sin was in the heart of his son. Too often we think Noah got up, got mad that his son made a big joke about it, and so he cursed his son. From now on, you're dust. That's not what happens. That's not how cursings happen. Noah is a righteous man. He sinned here, but he's a righteous man. He saw what was in his son's heart. It was revealed by this situation. Do you know that most of your sin, what it is, it isn't that it changes your heart. It reveals your heart. It reveals something in us. And it revealed to him that his son's heart had this flaw. And he realized that that flaw was going to be carried into his progeny. He didn't bring down this curse. He recognized that the curse was there. Curse is Canaan. He's going to be a servant of servants, shall he be to his brothers. It's interesting he doesn't put it on Ham. You'd think, cursed is Ham. But Ham was blessed of God. He was back in 9 verse 1, blessed. He was carried through. He was saved from God's judgment. This sinful heart is going to increase in his son who hadn't been through that. And it was going to increase in his son and increase in his son. And it was going to just carry forward. This youngest son, Canaan, either did something not shown to us in this episode, or he's the one who carries the sinful trait of Ham, but it's passed into their sinful line, who become over the years and centuries enemies of God's people and God's line. Do you know if you go to Leviticus 18, you don't have to go there now, many of the Canaanite sins are listed. And do you know what you find prevalent in all of the Canaanite sins? They have to do with uncovering nakedness, incest, adultery of many kinds, bestiality, homosexuality, idolatry to the point of child sacrifice. They're an impure people who are consumed with sexual impurities in their hearts. Do you know that the people of Sodom and Gomorrah, do you know what they were? Canaanites. So you can understand as the Israelites are reading Moses' words, having been told to go in and take the land promised and to destroy and displace the Canaanites who settled there, they would now see God's providence as well as his promises and judgment fulfilled. You're going to meet the Canaanites' offspring several more times in Genesis, and I will tell you it's never in a good light. And then he says in verse 26, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. Right off the bat, look at this. He doesn't bless Shem. He blesses the Lord and the God of Shem. By blessing Shem's God, we see who it is that's carrying the line, don't we? This is the line from the woman's seed through to Mary and the Christ. We'll see God's covenant blessings abound in these Shemites. Later on, they'll be called Semites. It's where you get the Semitic people of Shem. And Japheth. May God enlarge Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem and let Canaan be his servant. You're going to see some interesting things about those that come from Japheth next week in chapter 10. Verse 28, after the flood, Noah lived 350 years. Nothing more about Noah. All the days of Noah were 950 years and he died. At our prayer meeting, it was brought up that Lent started for a lot of the folks around the world this last week. And so oftentimes when you talk to people about Lent, it's like, I'm giving this up for God. This morning, I'm not asking you to give up anything for God. I'm asking you to give up something for you. You need to make some changes in your life. Every single one of us needs to make some changes in our life. We have calloused hearts because of what we allow our eyes to see. We have compromised consciences because of the sin that we allow to remain unchecked in our lives. We've handicapped our minds. We've quenched the Spirit's influence. We think too little of sin and its ugliness. Because in comparison to everything we see, it has to be pretty heinous for it to get our attention. If you keep your eyes focused on him and his holiness and his righteousness and his goodness, you'll be surprised how quickly your sensitivities will be restored. How quickly you'll see sin from a distance rather than waiting until it's already bitten you. Be careful, little eyes, what you see. Careful, little feet, where you go. It's good counsel that we teach our little children. Beloved, we've got to make changes in our hearts and in our life. And I know it's going to take God's strength and God's work in you to do that. It's going to be sacrificial. It's going to hurt. But we think too little of our sin. We think too little of protecting brothers and sisters in sin. How quick are we to talk about someone else's sin? There's a lot of pastors who've fallen in this last year. It gets broadcast all over the news. There's folks that fall in our congregations. It gets broadcast all through the prayer meetings. What should have Ham done? It isn't pushing it under the carpet. That's not what we're talking about. It's recognizing in a brother or sister there's sin there and it's not befitting. It's so ugly. And I love you and this isn't who you are. That you've been saved by grace. You have the Holy Spirit dwelling inside of you. You are God's chosen. You are the one he's placed his love upon. You're my brother. I've been there. I'm coming alongside with you and I'm going to put this blanket on you and I'm going to sit there next to you and guard you until you awaken from this sin so that you and I together can go to our God and clean this up. And when you find me laying naked on the floor, I hope you'll do the same for me because I need you. And I'm talking to you right now as your pastor, beloved. I need you. We need to be willing to come alongside one another and have awkward conversations. And it isn't to go be judging everybody else around you. Your preoccupation should be looking at yourself. Did a lot of self-looking this week. Oh, it's my prayer that you'll do the same. We need to stand for his righteousness and his holiness and see the beauty that's found in our God and yearn for it, fight for it.